Welcome to another episode of Historical. As always, your hosts are myself, Matt Nelson, and my fellow Jedi Knight, Wayne Bridgman. Say hi to the folks, Wayne.
Jedi Knight, eh? Well, someone's clearly excited about Rogue One, aren't they?
I was indeed. I was childish with delight when I watched Rogue One. It was fantastic. So happy new year to you
yes,
all.
Yes, happy new year. 2017 already.
So let's hope 2017 is a little better than the bloodbath that was 2016. It's been truly awful year. Yes, yes indeed.
I enjoyed
Perhaps demonstrated.
That was great.
Well, personally for me, it's been a great year. 2016 is one I remember as fantastic. But for the world as well, geopolitics aside, it was demonstrated perhaps by the year in review that was aired on TV recently over New Year's Day in the UK.
Good.
Deaths of our beloved singers and celebrities
very
were more
sad.
Common than bargain hunters outside this Boxing Day sales. And there was, of course, frightening election results, both in the UK and around the world.
Or deeply exciting, depending on
your political leaning, of course, yes. And war, of course, the gloom of war. But interspersed with that was Team GB's performance at the Olympics, which we all celebrated, and of course Andy Murray winning Wimbledon. So after all that excitement and, particularly bloodbath 2016, we need a drink. So Wayne, what is your favourite drink?
Well, Matt, I'm a man of simple pleasures, actually. And for me, perhaps maybe a nice pint of English real ale quenches my thirst.
You're not into cocktails?
No, actually. Well, I say that. If I was to have a nice cocktail, I'd probably go for a gin and tonic. I mean, I know it's only got two components, not really that much of an exciting cocktail, but the key to a good gin and tonic, as all of our gin drinkers out there all know.
I'm a fond gin drinker.
So I think it sounds like you've had some
gin. I need some gin.
Of course, tonic water, very important. Slice of cucumber. Yeah. Ice, and I say sort of between 7 to 8 shots of gin. That makes it about the right strength.
Yeah, now that's a drink that I drink. Mm. Oh, yes. So drinking of alcohol and the abuse of alcohol is a very apt subject for today's podcast. Listeners, of course, you will have read the title of this podcast, which, of course, is Prohibition.
Oh, I wonder what he's getting at here.
But it's back in the US in the 1920s when this happened, and people spoke very different back then. They did, Wayne. Oh, yes, they did.
They did in those days. So to get us into that sort of rip-roaring 1920s can-do mood, or can't-do mood, if we're talking about alcohol.
Oh, yes.
At that particular time. Now, we need to get a bit into the dialogue of the day here, listeners, to sort of bring you back to the kind of people you'd be dealing with and how they lived and how you'd interact with them and so on. For example, you could say, Matt,
I spoke different in them days and they lived different lives.
That sort of thing. Different times, isn't it?
Different, yeah. Yeah.
Right. Okay, so anyway, let's get our more of that later. Let's get our heads around some of the jargon now, some of these words that we'd expect to find in those days. Matt, see if you can get your mouth around this.
Right, well,
this word here.
So in those days, guys, listeners, they called a clam a dollar. So can you spot me a few clams?
Of course, a clam means something very different these days when it's a group of men talking about it. Another word for your listeners is dewdropper. That means a young, unemployed guy sort of sleeps around all day. An alternate synonym for that would be a lollygagger, one of my favourites.
Again, has different connotations nowadays.
What are you doing with that lolly?
You're gagging on. Okay, and then we have an egg. Eggman. He's a funny egg, that guy. He's a funny egg.
I see, all right, yeah.
Egg is a man.
Now, the next one, fire extinguisher. Now, that is a chaperone. You can sort of see how that works, can't you? Chaperone.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, you got your fire extinguisher with you? Gams. Is there really a better way to say legs than gams? Is it objectifying?
Well,
pins, stilts, or maybe getaway sticks? So you go, cheese it, it's the fuzz. Move your getaway sticks or I'll end up in the cooler.
Yes, must remember to compliment my wife on that. I like your getaway sticks. I'm not sure if that's going to go down too well. Mind you,
She's got a nice pair of gams, which of course is legs, listeners. Legs. Nothing else.
So, next one. Hootsie Tootsie. That's sort of like perfect. The cat's pyjamas, the dog's bollocks. It's basically very good. Or phrase-wise, you might say something like, I have to go and see a man about a dog. Wink, wink. That would mean to go and buy whiskey.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, go see a man about a dog. Yeah, yeah, right. And I'd say that's phonus balonus, which means nonsense. Also related to that is baloney, which is piffle.
Yeah.
Or also nonsense. Or bollocks.
And then we've got, back on the drink, we've got quilt. Quilt, like a blanket, you know, so that's a drink that warms its drinker.
I quite like that one. I like that. I want a strong quilt.
I
need a shot of quilt. I'm feeling cold. I need to be warmed. But tell it to the Sweeney. Yeah. Go say it to someone who believes your phone is balonus. So go say it to the Sweeney. Mm. Go, someone else going to believe your phone is balonus around here.
Makes you wonder how those phrases ever fell out of favour. So hopefully that gives you a few phrases there, listeners, to give you a taste for the error. And of course, our incredibly realistic accents, of which we've been complimented on at least, well, you know, we've been complimented on those before. So
back just to, can't think of any times where, I mean, nothing comes to mind at the moment about the accents. I mean, I'm sure someone once complimented us about,
yeah, or they thought it or something.
They just never bothered to tell us or say it, really. But yeah.
So back to Prohibition and liquor.
No, I'm not that forward. As I said, it was just a kiss on her cheek.
Oh.
Now, what was that about Prohibition? Was it, listeners, the stupidest thing America ever did? Or was it essentially to curb the booze habits of a population to save the sanctimony of the family home?
Oh, yeah.
People had to drown their sorrows, after all. As are slightly more than 50% of the US population, currently with the recent election results.
Well, yeah, interesting you say about preserving the sanctimony of the family home, of course, because gin in this country used to be called Mother's Ruin.
Mother's Ruin,
it?
Indeed.
You know, the gin houses, trying to ban that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, well, I've got to say, it seems not a subject. I love a drop of cider. What do you like in cider?
Well, like I said, Wayne, it was just a kiss on the cheek. We haven't got to that stage yet. Can we stop talking about my personal life?
Oh.
And talk about Prohibition. Officially, Prohibition started in January 1920 as a countrywide law.
Mm.
It was last orders at the bars in the US on that day.
Yeah.
Better make mine a triple.
No change there, then.
Yeah, easy. Actually, it's very true. It's probably worse than a triple sometimes. Quadruple. Loads of states had tried Prohibition before this, but this was different because this was not a state decision. This was a federal decree. Uncle Sam was a disapproving and rather grumpy uncle on that day. I looked down on anyone foolish enough to want to drink post-January 1920. From sozzled to sober.
If only it was that easy.
But was it going to be that easy? And how did the state of affairs get to such a place where the whole country was banned from drinking? Was this seemingly insane act of banning alcohol an act of madness, or was it a sane, viable policy as the Yanks can't handle their drink?
The consumption of alcoholic beverages in their various guises, whilst bringing Matt and myself years of endless pleasure...
Well, and hangovers and forgotten memories.
That's right. Has in fact been a contentious topic, actually, in America since the colonial period, since the early days. In the rest of the world, especially in Europe... It's been a part of our everyday lives before we can remember. The German beer halls, English ales, French wine and champagne, and pissed up Vikings is part of the culture. In fact, my mother, I'm sure like yours, raised Indeed. Me not on milk, but actually on the proven age-old remedy of a 30-year-old single malt whiskey.
It was the norm in those days.
The heady...
Yeah. The heady 70s.
Rather heady days they were, yes, indeed. Actually, that didn't happen, I should say, just in case Mum's listening. My mother was and is still a very responsible person and has turned me into the very balanced individual that some people might think I am today.
Even in the Middle Ages, Europeans have been drinking alcohol for millennia. Be it ancient Rome getting the wines in to spice up an orgy, to Friar Tuck brewing beer to keep Robin Hood and his merry men very merrily pissed up indeed. Yeah. That said, there were many high-profile victims in those eras where alcoholism affected their ability to do their job.
Yep.
You know, we think of Caligula, one of our previous podcasts, focuses.
Genghis Khan, of course.
Genghis Khan, yeah. Many leaders. But in America, it was a less smooth ride into the lovable intoxication that we all know and love. But the question is, why?
Why indeed? Well, apart from the obvious health issues here, a quote from America in the 18th century tells us the story. It says, "Drunkenness was condemned and punished, but only as an abuse of a God-given gift. Drink itself was not looked upon as culpable any more than food deserved blame for the sin of gluttony. Excess was a personal indiscretion." So, America was from the outset a God-fearing country, of course, and indulgent of any kind, any sort of indulgence, did not sit well at all with these guys, did it, man?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
They're saying
the Puritan
basically...
Puritan values.
Yeah, that's right. They're saying in the quote, use a bit of self-restraint.
For God's sake!
Something over the years of your intoxication, Matt, I believe you've struggled with.
What are you saying, Wayne? Yeah. You say Matt Nelson here, me, handle my booze. That's fighting talk outside now. I will admit that there has been the odd occasion of intoxication.
The odd weekly occasion.
And unconsciousness through the years. And I don't back away from that. But it's been some fun as well along the way.
We're older and wiser people now.
So, back to America's issues with alcohol. Its roots go way back, but it helps set the scene for why Prohibition happened in the USA and not in Europe. Because people here and there both love to drink. Shortly after the United States had obtained its independence from
Lucky.
The British Empire.
Lucky.
Something, of course, we're very happy they did. A thing called the Whiskey Rebellion took place in western Pennsylvania in protest of government-imposed taxes on whiskey. The soldiers had fought a hard war against the British, and our friend Sergeant Whiskey had played a vital part in helping them get through the horrors of the war. A bit of post-traumatic stress disorder, can't sleep at night, repeated nightmares about the horrors of war, down a glass or two of whiskey. A vivid flashback of a battlefield, maybe three. Bingo. This continued post-war and caused some major social issues that I'm sure you can imagine.
Yes, well, awful drunken behaviour.
Urinating out of windows, for example.
That sort of thing, awful, yes. Fisticuffs.
Pugilism, of course, that's fighting listeners.
Yeah, pretending to see goblins running around. Remember that, Matt? Was that something unique to you?
They only come out when I'm very, very drunk, Wayne. They're the special drunken goblins.
I see.
Yes.
Okay, you know, sort of ting traffic, wandering around with mascara streaming down your face, wetting yourself. And very sadly, also, sort of spousal abuse are also byproducts of this level of intoxication in American society right now. Not good. So although the taxes on whiskey were primarily levied to help pay down the newly formed national debt, it also received support from some social reformers who hoped a sin tax, as they called it, would raise public awareness about the harmful effects of alcohol.
Now, the whiskey tax was repealed after Thomas Jefferson, who was fond of a tumbler or two of the strong stuff, came into power in the 1800s. Benjamin Rush, one of the foremost physicians in the late 18th century, believed in moderation rather than prohibition. Mm-hmm. His book, The Inquiry into the Effects of Ardent Spirits Upon the Human Body and Mind.
So 1784.
Yeah. Rush argued that the excessive use of alcohol was injurious to physical and psychological health, labelling drunkenness as a disease.
Well,
the first time it was labelled as a disease. Apparently influenced by Rush's widely discussed belief, about 200 farmers in Connecticut community formed a temperance society in 1789, and this was key.
And,
this was the beginning of it.
And similar associations and societies like that were formed in Virginia in 1800 and New York in 1808 then. And within a decade, other temperance groups had also formed in eight states, some of them being statewide organisations, of course. So, the ball's really starting to pick up some moss here. The words of Rush and other early temperance reformers served to demonise, Matt, the use of alcohol for men and women, dogs and cats. I mean, I don't know who's given their cat a little bit of whiskey.
Even the field mice were not immune from this kind of pressure. Where would we be without a drunken gerbil? Certainly Richard Gere knows a thing or two about that.
Allegedly, that is,
yeah. Get the allegedly. While whitely men enjoy drinking and often considered...
the use of gerbils?
Drink, that is. Oh, right. That it was vital for their health. Incredibly, they didn't see the risks of drink at all.
It's like cigarettes, isn't it? They're supposed to be good for you.
Cigarettes are good for your lungs, and if you're stressed, have a drink. Brilliant. Fantastic. Women began to embrace the ideology, though, of true motherhood.
Very nice.
And refrained from the consumption of alcohol. Middle-class women, who were considered the moral authorities of their households, consequently rejected the drinking of alcohol, which they believed to be a threat to the home.
Yes, very, very stern women, of course. Yes.
So far from the wine-guzzling women of today, of course. Mm. Actually, in 1830s, on average, America consumed, and this is quite amazing, 1.7 bottles of hard liquor per week.
On average, that is.
Three times the amount consumed in 2010.
Wow, that's a problem.
So that is almost two bottles of 40% gin per week.
Fire water.
A person would be drinking. Yeah,
wow, that's crazy.
So it's a lot, really, if you're an average person. So they were some pretty majorly strung out people who were pretty much modern day alcoholics. Of course, the term alcoholic was not really around in the 1920s. So maybe American government had to step in really and do something, as these people were drinking more than some 1980s heavy metal bands.
That really is saying something. Yeah. And so by 1835, this pressure's building now. The temperance movement had reached 1.5 million members now, and they're all pretty serious people, with women constituting the majority of its members, actually. The prohibition movement, also known as the Dry Crusade, I like that, continued in the 1840s by annoying sort of piety-filled religious disapproving types, especially the Methodists.
Never, ever ask a Methodist to arrange a party.
Oh, no? Why not?
Just don't, okay? It'll be shit.
Oh, okay, fine, right, I won't. The late 19th century saw the temperance movement broaden its focus from abstinence to include all behaviour and institutions related to alcohol consumption of any kind. Preachers such as Reverend Mark A. Matthews linked liquor dispensing saloons with political corruption. So now they're tugging at the trouser snake of power, Matt. What's going to happen?
The main law, they're tugging it off. And it's getting harder and harder to resist. The main law, adopted in 1851, which banned the manufacture and sale of liquor in Maine. However, it was repealed in 1856, so only 5 years after, because there had been major uprising and riots. People wanted to be bevied up and were willing to take to the streets to fight for their rights to get drunk on a Whitby Party 4.
That's a four-pack of lager, listeners.
Very popular in the sort of the 1980s. A temperance movement lost strength and was marginalised during the American Civil War. And that was 1861 to 1865. The need to fight and drink winning out at this period. Making the comment earlier about Sergeant Whiskey. He helped him fight.
Yeah, people don't care. If you're a soldier on the front line, you smoke, you drink, you don't really care about your health too much.
Because you could die in a second, really. Frances Willard, the second president of the Women's Temperance Movement, held the aims of the organisations were to create.
Is the mic on?
The mic's on.
Hello. The Union of Women from all denominations for the purpose of educating the young, forming a better public sentiment, reforming the drinking classes, transforming the power of divine grace, those who are enslaved by alcohol. We will remove the dram shops from our streets by law. I do declare.
She basically just didn't like alcohol.
She didn't, no. And the effects just caused.
So while still denied universal voting privileges, as in women could not vote yet, women in the WCTU followed Frances Willard's do everything doctrine and used temperance as a method of entering into politics and furthering other progressive issues.
Well, that's a good point. And in 1881, they had their first victory in Kansas, became the first state to outlaw alcoholic beverages in its constitution. Yeah. In particular, one crazy old battle axe.
Battle axes, you mean presumably militant WCTU advocate Matt, surely?
No, I actually mean one crazy old battle axe.
Oh, right.
This formidable bulldog in a dress was called Carrie Nation, and she gained notoriety for enforcing the state's ban on alcohol consumption by walking into saloons, scolding customers loudly and irritably, and using her axe. Yes, an axe, I mean, an actual axe. What? She walked in with an axe, which she used to destroy bottlers of liquor as the patrons were drinking them.
What's
so this old granny comes in, starts having a go at you about God, starts smashing up your alcohol in there with her axe, basically.
It's just what you want me trying to enjoy a quiet drink, isn't it? Well, she'd just wail into the bottles of booze, swinging her sort of a little hatchet thing, smashing booze and glasses to the four corners of the bar. So Carrie Nation recruited ladies into the Carrie Nation Prohibition Group. What did the formidable Carrie Nation think of sort of men in general and drinking culture in America?
I'm sure she was really positive about men.
Yeah, she seemed a bit of a stern type. Well, let's hear from the horse's mouth herself, shall we? Because in this rare interview, Matt, amazing we could get this sort of stuff. I don't know how we got this.
This is like an old gramophone from Nero. Remember the one we got from
that
Nero?
That was a miracle. I'm surprised I didn't get more money for that. But she gave Kansas News Corp back in the day.
Hey there, it's Jimmy Jones Jr., the third, here reporting outside the Kansas All Saints Methodist Church in sunny Kansas. It's hot enough to fry an egg out here, and I'm here today to talk politics, and especially about this growing Fonomino, the temperance movement, with a quite incredible person, and you're going to be surprised, guys, when you hear that person's voice. It's not the deep, booming, rich, lovely brown voice of a man. Unbelievably, it's actually a goddamn woman's voice. Yep, don't adjust your radio settings, listeners. You heard me right. A goddamn woman has actually grasped the complexities of politics. You heard it here first. They'll be giving them the vote at this rate. No, of course they won't. It's ridiculous. But I'd like to introduce the formidable Carrie Nation. Here she is. Come on, darling. Sit down. There we go.
Hello.
All right. Do you want some water or something? No? You okay?
I'm fine, thank you.
All right, good. So thank you for taking the time out of your important, in inverted commas, role of sort of baking and housekeeping, presumably, right, today?
Well, that's perfectly fine of you, sir. How can I be of assistance to you today?
Well, you've generated quite a bit of a reputation for taking the temperance movement's anti-drinking madness message into the actual saloons, where God-fearing, good, honest, hard-working men like to talk about men's business and have a drink and relax before going home to spend time with a wife, assuming she's finished all of her chores. Could you tell us what exactly is it you do? What is it you do? Because I'm sure our listeners are all just fascinated to hear what the fairer sex is doing in politics right now.
Well, sir, I can tell you I do not like the use of the S word. Look here, Mr. Okay. Jones. We at the Carrie Nation Prohibition Group believe that America can only be great if it is a sober nation. We didn't win this nation's freedom by being drunk as skunks. We, in my group, simply make sure we bring our message into the saloons of men. Bloody, drunken, godless men, scum of the earth, can hear it, and they can take our message in.
Okay. Well, Carrie, you shouldn't worry your little head about this. You know, some people are taking it that you don't like men very much. Any truth to that rumour right there?
Well, Mr. Jones, let me be clear here. Men are nicotine-soaked, beer-besmirched, whiskey-drinking, red-eyed devils. and I'll have no one tell me anything different. My ladies are God-fearing. Oh, they fear the Lord. Oh, they fear him good. In fact, I'm proud to say my group cack themselves in the face of God.
Wow, that's some strong words there, Carrie. How
and listen here, young man. You listen here. When I go into the bars, we feel invincible. My strength was that of a giant. God was certainly standing by me then. I smashed up 5 saloons with rocks before I ever took up the hatchet. Oh, yes. That's what you snivelling men are. Like cowed, like frightened sheep, they did.
Jesus.
Don't blaspheme.
What's the end game here, though? Surely you can't expect men quit drinking. I mean, we have very few pleasures in this life. One being women like a good self, of course. Well, not like yourself. In this life. And drinking drowns out the pains of the life and the wife.
Young man, not only do I want drink banned, but I want all hellions of to quit puffing the hell fume in God's clean air. You have put me in here a cub, but I will come out roaring like a lion. I will make all hell howl.
Well, ma'am, just calm down for a second. I won't agree and let you do this, okay? As a drinker myself, I'll not be bowed down to you, you loud, irritable old head.
Ooh.
You see this here? You see this here? It's a hip flask. And in it, I got me some whiskey. Yes, whiskey. What are you going to do as I drink it? I'm drinking it right now. Here I go.
The destroyer of the works of the devil by the order of God. My hit of justice will teach you. Take this. And this.
Cut the commercial. Not the face. Wow, she was...
One feisty old granny, huh?
Yeah, quite a scary lady. Mm. She said... These were all real quotes, by the way.
When we wrote that scene, basically, we just took quotes that Carrie Nation did and put that into that scene.
She did actually
come out with devil besmirched, red-eyed whores or whatever it was. She said.
Yeah, she said of a preacher caught drinking in a saloon, actually, "What a man to dress like a saint and smell like a devil." Before presumably smashing up his drink of ashes.
While Carrie Nation's vigilante techniques were rare, other activists enforced the dry cause by entering saloons, singing, praying, and urging shopkeepers not to sell alcohol. Yeah. Less dramatic, I suspect, and probably less effective as well. If anything, it would be nice to have a backdrop of music after you're having a drink.
Yes, well, it's nice for liberals to try and make a difference there, but what does that say about the society, though? Hmm? Drunkards? Other dry states, especially those in the South, enacted prohibition legislation, as did individual counties within a state. And momentum was really building now, Matt, like pistons on a steam train.
Or a fat man running down a steep hill.
That works too.
Court cases also debated the subject to prohibition. While some cases ruled in opposition, in general, tendency was towards support of prohibition. A US Justice Harlan commented,
"We cannot shut out or view the fact within the knowledge of all that the public health, the public morals, and the public safety may be endangered by the general use of intoxicating drinks, nor the fact established by statistics accessible to everyone that the idleness, disorder, pauperness, and crime existing in the country are, in some degree, traceable to this evil drink."
So what he's saying is, alcohol is causing all the problems.
Yeah, and he could be right in some people's eyes, of course. But all this didn't actually curb alcohol at all, though. In fact, they probably discussed this over a beer in the Congress bar. And proliferation of neighbourhood saloons in the post-Civil War era became a bit of a phenomenon, actually, within an increasingly industrialised urban workforce. I'm not saying that, the working classes or working men tend to drink more than some of their more educated counterparts, but, I'm saying that. Because...
Dodgy ground, Mr. Bridgman.
Working men's bars were popular sort of social gathering places, really, from the workplace and home life. Of course, with no TV or PlayStation or Xbox...
Some of our listeners
other
will not
consoles
be able
are
to
available.
Not be able to contemplate this a world without these devices.
Yeah, so the men had to go and sort of find their solace in these bars, really. Saloons were more often than not linked to a specific brewery, actually, like they are today in most cases in the UK, where the saloon keeper's operation was financed by a brewer and contractually obligated to sort of sell the brewer's products to the exclusion of competing brands.
Yes, absolutely. A saloon's business model often included the offer of a free lunch.
Very nice, yes.
But as the saying goes, there is nothing such as a free lunch.
A free lunch and very, very expensive drinks.
Yeah. So where the bill of fare commonly consisted of a heavily salted food that you would eat, that the heavily salted aspect would induce you to want to drink more. The clever bastards,
like pork scratchings or crisps.
Well, exactly that. And of course, they do that with modern bar snacks today.
Nuts.
No, it's actually true.
Salted nuts.
Check next time you're at the bar, listeners. All salt-based, these products are.
Yeah.
Heavy salt.
Check the label.
So they're still up to their old tricks. Now, leading up to the eventual ban, we enter what is called the Progressive Era. Mm. And this is from 1890 to when it was banned in
1920.
Wasn't
it? Yeah.
Hostility towards saloons and their political influence became widespread, with the Anti-Saloon League superseding
ASL.
The Prohibition Party and the Women's Christian Temperance Union.
WCTU.
As the most influential advocate of prohibition. Okay, it was getting politicised.
Right, well... Prohibition was an important force, actually, in state and local politics from the 1840s through to the 1900s. And prohibition was supported by a whole host of people, some that you might not suspect, that would not know a good time if it hit them right in the balls. Like Methodists, your Northern Baptists, your Southern Baptists, your New School Presbyterians, your Disciples of Christ, your Congregationalists, your Quakers,
I note the Satanic League of America was absent, probably at a bar somewhere getting hammered.
No, we'd have a little sort of a Cointreau, an orange liqueur. Couldn't get enough of it. As indeed was the College of Witchcraft and Buggery, who were otherwise engaged. The genie of prohibition emerges from a bottle labelled intolerance.
Women's suffrage, the right to vote, since women tended to support prohibition, was tied tightly together with prohibition.
Yeah, it would be.
You scratch my hairy male back, and I'll scratch your warm, smooth skin with oils. That kind of thing.
No thanks. Well, in January 1917...
Yeah, what I was trying to say there is that the women are scratching the men's backs. Yeah, there wasn't in any way a come-on to Wayne.
Right, it's
good. Make sure that was absolutely not the case whatsoever.
In January 1917 now, the dries...
I'm not built that way.
The dries outnumbered the wets. Wets, of course, being the ones who wanted to drink, by 140-64... in the Democratic Party, and 138-62, about the same, amongst the Republicans. With America's declaration of war against Germany in April, remember, 1917, the major force against prohibition were sidelined and their protests subsequently ignored, for war and battles had forever been linked with booze and intolerance.
But this time, a twist in the tale. A new justification for prohibition arose. Prohibiting... the production of alcoholic beverage would allow more resources, especially grain, that would otherwise have been used to make alcohol,
be
devoted devoted to the war effort.
Right, clever.
A resolution calling for a constitution amendment to accomplish nationwide prohibition was introduced and passed by both houses in December 1917.
Hands down, yeah.
By January the 16th, 1919, the end of the war now, the amendment had been ratified by 36 to 48 states, needed to ensure that its passage came
it's
into
pretty
law.
Big, yeah.
Then in October 28th, 1919, Congress passed enabling legislation known as the Volstead Act to ensure the 18th Amendment then went into effect in 1920. The dries must have been singing, the wets must have been drowning their sorrows for the last time in alcohol.
Yes, and the dries would have been probably singing in tune because they were completely sober.
Yeah.
But talking of singing, Louis Armstrong, of course, we all know and love him, the famous singer of the time, was 18, actually, at the time of Prohibition, and he had this to say in his unmistakable voice.
We've all the time in the world to talk about that, if we should drink or not in America. But I reckon the good old jazz music is the cure to the nation's woes. Oh, jeepers creepers, my new single out next week. Buy it, kids, buy loads, blueberry hill moon, yeah.
Sounds like something off the Muppet Show.
I'm not sure what Louis was saying there, yeah, but he was around in the time, which was the main thing.
It's always been hard to understand, but Prohibition began on January the 16th, 1920, when the 18th Amendment went into effect. A total of 1,520 federal prohibition agents...
This was police forces for holding the prohibition law.
Yeah, they were tasked with enforcement.
Supporters of the amendment soon became confident that it would not be repealed. One of its creators, Senator Morris Shepherd, joked that there is as little chance of repealing the 18th Amendment as there would be of a hummingbird to fly to the planet Mars with the Washington Monument tied to its tail. Clearly, he didn't have his fingers anywhere near the pulse of the nation, because going into prohibition was not going to be a smooth ride.
Got that one wrong. Well, prohibition became highly controversial, of course, among medical professionals, because alcohol was widely prescribed by the era's physicians for therapeutic purposes, wasn't it?
Congress, yes, it was.
Yeah, thank you. Congress held hearings on the medicinal value of beer in 1921, for example. Subsequently, physicians across the country lobbied
as well, though.
They lobbled, probably lobbled. Yeah, sort of like,
before lobbying.
Hobbled in.
They lobbled in.
they lobbied for the repeal of prohibition as it applied to medicinal liquors. So Jack Daniels managed to blag the right to somehow survive the purge. From 1921 to 1930, doctors earned about $40 million for whiskey prescriptions.
Yeah. Find different ways to get around the law. Perhaps similar now to medical prescribed marijuana. Since alcohol was legal in neighbouring countries, distilleries and breweries in Canada, Mexico and the Caribbean flourished as their product was consumed by the visiting Americans or smuggled into United States illegally from those places. As early as 1925, talk was out there that prohibition was not working. So 5 years after it came out, already people were sensing that it wasn't working.
Oh. Well, tell you what, Matt, I'm really interested to hear what historian Elizabeth Cohen writes about this.
Well, let me tell you what Elizabeth Cohen writes.
Oh, right, okay.
Just prohibition...
Plucks it out of the air. Plucks the quote out of the air.
Well, it's always been in the back of my mind. So yeah. She said, prohibition worked best when directed at a primary target, the working class poor.
See, I called it, didn't I, earlier?
A rich family could have a cellar full of liquor and get by, you see. Not quite what you thought, Wayne. It seemed, but if a poor family had one bottle of homebrew, there would be trouble. It's the same everywhere you go. The rich get away with it. Cheeky. Working class people were inflamed by the fact that their employers could dip into their private caches of booze while they were, the employees, not allowed to.
Yeah, the typical, the 1%, the bloody 1%, and the 63% moonshine.
Exactly. Yeah, that's it.
So before the 18th Amendment went into effect in January 1920, many of the upper classes stockpiled alcohol for legal home consumption after prohibition again. They bought the inventories of liquor retailers and wholesalers, emptying out their warehouses, saloons and club storerooms. President Woodrow Wilson, at the time, moved his own supply of alcohol for... alcoholic beverages, in fact, to his Washington residence after his term of office ended, and his successor, Warren G. Harding, relocated his own large supply into the White House, of all places, after inauguration.
In October 1930, just 2 weeks before the congressional midterm elections, bootlegger George Cassidy, the man in the green hat... No, I'd have no idea. He probably had a green hat. He came forward and told how he had bootlegged for 10 years for members of Congress.
Typical.
One of the few bootleggers ever to tell his story, Cassidy wrote a 5 front page article for the Wall Street Post in which he estimated that 80% of congressmen and senators drank. The scandal of it, Wayne.
One law for us, another law for them.
Hypocrites. Bloody politicians, you can't trust them. The Democrats in the North were mostly wits.
And that's, they liked the idea of drinking. Not that they were weak. They were just, it was called Wets. And in 1932 election, they made majority gains. The Wets argued that prohibition was not stopping crime. It was actually causing the creation of large-scale, well-organised and well-funded crime syndicates.
Well-organised crime organisations. I wonder who might crop up when we start talking about this. And of course they were correct, Matt, weren't they? One of the main reasons why prohibition did not proceed smoothly was the inefficient means of enforcing it. Law enforcement found themselves overwhelmed by the rise in illegal, wide-scale alcohol distribution across the country. Also, stopping drinking, it ain't that easy, Matt. Anyone heard of alcoholism?
Yeah, talking of which, shall we pause for a drink?
No, carry on.
No, okay, it's fine, because we're not alcoholics, we're fine. Yeah, we're fine. Clergymen were sometimes called upon to form a vigilante group to assist with enforcement of prohibition. Now, can you imagine that? Loads of vicars marching down the street with their white collars, wielding truncheons.
Anti-liquor vicars.
I like that.
That's what should have called them.
Furthermore, American geography. Furthermore, American geography contributed to difficulties in enforcing prohibition. The varied terrain of valleys, mountains, lakes, and swamps, as well as excessive and extensive seaways, ports, and borders, which the United States shared with Canada and Mexico, made it exceedingly difficult for prohibition agents to stop bootleggers given their lack of resources.
Yeah. Build a wall! No, don't do it. It's not practical in those days.
Get the Mexicans to do it!
When the Great Depression struck in 1929, very sad times, Matt, state governments urgently needed the tax revenue alcohol sales are generating. Franklin Roosevelt was elected in 1932, of course, based in part on his promise to end prohibition.
Of course.
I don't know whether he spun that for tax reasons or not, but the people got their booze from all manner of places, Matt. The barber's shop that out the back has a hidden room with tables. A bar full of people in the know having a drink or three out there. These places were called speakeasies.
I'm going down to speakeasies.
Going down to speakeasies.
I'm
going to
go to see the man about a dog.
At the speakeasy.
At the speakeasy.
And these were literally all over the place. And some ingenious work actually went into building these places up. You ever seen those sort of films, they were old films where the police go in and so the tables flip round
and turn, disappear, yeah.
And that sort of thing going on. They think that in New York alone, there was an amazing 30,000 of these things in 1928. That's a lot of places to quench a thirst, Matt, considering it's illegal. Probably more, in fact, than before Prohibition.
Exactly. Organised crime received a major boost from Prohibition as they supplied the demand, the ever-growing demand. Mafia organised bootlegging emerged in response to Prohibition. A profitable, often violent black market for alcohol flourished. Prohibition provided a financial basis for organisations to flourish.
Yeah. Well, in a study of more than 30 major US cities during Prohibition years of 1920 and 21, the number of crimes actually increased by 24%, a quarter.
Ooh, that's a lot.
Additionally, theft and burglaries increased by 9%, homicides by 12.7%, assaults and burglaries rose by 13%, unlucky for some. Drug addiction rose by shocking 44.6%, and police department costs rose in accordance by 11.4%.
So maybe not the greatest way of saving money and making America safe.
Mm.
Apparently 75% of statistics, though, are made up on the spot.
I have 50-50 on believing you on that.
Stronger liquor surged in popularity because its potency made it more profitable to smuggle. To prevent bootleggers from using industrial ethanol alcohol to produce illegal beverages, the federal government ordered, and you're not going to believe this, listeners, the poisoning of industrial alcohols.
What?
Yes, that's right. The government started to poison its citizens. Jeez. In response, bootleggers hired chemists who successfully renatured the alcohol to make it drinkable and safe. It was like a booze cold war or stroke arms race, each side trying to get one ahead of the other.
Wow. So, and as chemists from both sides tried to outdo one another, the Treasury Department required manufacturers to add more deadly poisons, including the particularly deadly industrial methyl alcohol. Terrible stuff. New York City medical examiners prominently opposed these policies because of the danger to human life, obviously. And this is going to be a bit of a shock to you if you don't know about this already. As many as 10,000 people, all of which had families and friends, died from drinking denatured alcohol before Prohibition ended. Now, I'm going to ask you a question here, see if you can figure out yourselves what the answer is going to be. Did anyone go to prison for this?
Answer?
No. Of course not.
Yeah. Hmm. So New York City medical examiner Charles Norris believed the government should take responsibility for the murder when they knew the poison was not deterring people, and they continued to poison industrial alcohol anyway. Norris remarked, "The government knows it's not stopping drinking by putting poison in alcohol, yet it continues its poisoning process, heedless to the fact that people are determined to drink are daily absorbing that poison. Knowing this to be true, the United States government must be charged with the moral responsibility for the deaths that poisoned liqueur causes, although it cannot be held legally responsible."
Get that disclaimer in there. So, who are the real criminals? Can you believe the elected government actually poisoned its electorate?
It's the businessman in his suit and tie.
The establishment, Matt.
The establishment.
Another lethal substance that was often substituted for alcohol was canned heat, it was called, also commonly known as sterno. Forcing the substance through a makeshift filter, such as a handkerchief or something, created a rough liquor substitute. However, the result was poisonous, although not always lethal. Many of those who were poisoned as a result united to sue the government, actually, for reparations after the end of Prohibition.
Understandably so. Making alcohol at home was very common during Prohibition. Stores sold grape concentrate with warning labels that listed the steps that should be avoided. If you wanted to, for example, create wine, do not.
That would be a terrible mistake.
Please don't add the contents of this product into a fermenting bin. Please don't add XX grams of sugar. Please. And do not then add XX litres of water.
And please, whatever you do, don't leave this in the warm room for 2 months to ferment. Really, don't do that.
Some drugstores sold medicinal wine, which was around 22% alcohol content. In order to justify the sale, the wine was given a disgusting medicinal taste. Home brewing good hard liquor was easier than brewing good beer, since selling privately distilled alcohol was illegal and bypassed government taxation. Law enforcement officers relentlessly pursued home manufacturers.
And then in response, bootleggers modified their cars and trucks by enhancing the engines and suspensions to make, well, firstly, faster vehicles that they presumed, you know, would improve their chances of outrunning and escaping agents of the Bureau of Prohibition, commonly called revenue agents or revenuers. As an early version of Tim Westwood, these guys sort of seriously pimped up their rides, and their cars became known as Moonshine Runners, or Shine Runners. One of the band, wasn't there? Moonshine Runners.
Their mechanical skills developed as they learned to drastically increase the horsepower of these vehicles to outrun the authorities. This created a culture of car lovers in the southern part of the United States that eventually grew into the popular NASCAR racing series.
Oh, I see.
In fact, the winner of the first ever NASCAR competition, they'd used that car, basically, to bootleg alcohol just a week earlier.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. Moonshine, listeners, got its name as it was brewed, the liquor was brewed at night only by the illumination of the glare of the moon.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, out of the way of everybody. While on the subject of how things got their name, bootleggers are the smugglers who transport brews and sell it. And in colonial times, these distributors would conceal their product inside their tall riding boots, which is obviously how they got the name, bootleggers.
Bootleggers. So shops were also known to participate in the underground liquor market by loading their stocks with ingredients for liquors, including Benedictine, mm-hmm. Vermouth,
lovely.
Scotch mash, and even ethanol alcohol.
Delicious.
Which anyone could purchase legally. So you can't put all the ingredients together, but all the ingredients are there to purchase. It's worth having a look at some of these phrases that bootleggers use, though.
Yes, these are good. So firstly, we're gonna go with a phrase called blind pig. That's an illegal drinking establishment, a.k.a. a speakeasy, that attempted to evade police detection by charging patrons a fee to gaze upon some sort of, you know, exotic creature like a blind pig, very exotic, or a tiger, a bit more exotic, and be given a complimentary cocktail upon arrival, maybe a canapé too.
A Jake walk.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Jake walk. A paralysis or loss of muscle control in the hands and feet due to an overconsumption of a Jamaican ginger.
We've all been there.
A.K.A. Jake. Illegal substance with an alcoholic base. The numbness left led sufferers to walk with a distinct gait that was also known as a Jake leg or a Jake foot.
Hmm.
We in the UK have a name for this. It's called being trolleyed.
Yes, or simply drunk.
Yes. So,
yeah, next one is Skid Road. Nothing to do with the humorous Skid Mark, of course, or the band. Fronted by the very attractive Sebastian Bach.
Skid Row.
A precursor to the term Skid Row, a skid road was a place where loggers hauled their goods, of course, skidded along. During Prohibition, these roads became popular meeting places for the bootleggers.
Going to meet you down the Skid Road. Mm. I particularly like this one. A brick of wine. A brick of wine.
Brick of wine.
Okay, so wine fans looking to get their vino fix could simply add water to the dehydrated block of juice, which would then become wine. Can you imagine it? So you'd have this brick of wine, add water to it, you got yourself a jug of wine.
Nice little party trick there. And then we've got bathtub gin.
I can imagine that tasted horrible
there. Yeah, it must be awful.
Really, really horrible wine. Bathtub gin.
Bathtub gin, that's a homemade, often poorly made, that is, gin that was preferably served in a bottle so tall but it could not be mixed with water from a sink tap, right? So it was mixed in a bathtub instead. Though the phrase references gin specifically, it came to be used as a general term for any type of cheap homemade booze. So they don't want to allow people to be able to dilute it, water it down the tap.
Or white not lightning. White lightning. The whiskey equivalent to bathtub gin, a highly potent, illegal, made and poor quality spirit. Sounds great. And we used to have
there was a brand cider
called White Lightning. Yeah. And it took its name from it.
And the next one, of course, we've got a phrase called whale. A heavy, heavy drinker. Like, he's whaling in a drink tonight. Look at him go.
Then we've got hooch. Again, this was a drink in the UK in the 90s. Low-quality liquor, usually whiskey. The term originated in the late 1800s as a short version of hoochio, a distilled beverage from Alaska that became popular during the gold rush. The phrase came back into use in the 1920s.
Okay, and my personal favourite actually is giggle water. An alcoholic beverage, basically, that is. Giggle water, any sort of beverage, giggle water. Look, he's drunk some alcohol, he's giggling. Well, was it easy to get served at a speakeasy, though, Matt? That's what I want to know. We've been going through this phrase. How do you get served if I'm going in there? How did you know where they were as well? Why don't we go back and find out?
Let's do that. Right. Let's do that right now. Here's the place I was told about. Billy Bob's Barbershop. So this is where all the lads are getting their knockoff booze from. Well, no one's around, so I may well just give this a try. See what the fuss is about.
Hey, sir. Sir?
Hey, what?
You want your shoes shined, sir?
No.
Only cost a cent.
Hey, no thanks, kid. I'm fine.
Hey, mister. What? I'm the best shoe shiner in the world. Your shoes are really filthy, mister.
Hey, shoot, kid, you know? I said I don't want no shoe shine. You get off now before I take my belt and goddammit, I tell you, I'll give you a hiding. Now scamper, kid, scamper.
Okay, mister. Hey.
Hey, what?
Up yours, mister. Up yours.
Up. Get up with you. Oh, man, kids today, man.
Up yours.
Kids to Jesus. Okay, no one's around. Okay, so here goes with the secret knock.
Okay, who's there?
It's Tony. It's me, Jimmy.
Jimmy who?
What do you mean, Jimmy who? It's Jimmy. Jimmy Jones Jr. We went to high school together.
I don't know no Jimmy Jones Jr.
Tony, I married your sister, for God's sake.
I don't know what you're talking about, mister. Say the password.
Oh, Jesus H. Christ.
No, that's not it.
No, the password. Oh, it's the password.
Shatner's bassoon. Okay?
And what does he play on it? The bassoon?
He plays Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Hey, Jimmy Jones Jr. married to my sister Jemima.
Yes,
hey, Jimmy, come on in.
It's me.
Come on. What can I do for you today? We got some nice moonshine from the Rockies. I heard about some whiskey from Canada. Just come in last night.
Well, I was actually just coming in to get my hair cut. But I'll take a flask of that moonshine. I hear that'll put hairs on my chest.
Yeah, good choice, Jimmy, my old mucker. It just won't put hairs on your chest. It will crack them into a bee for you. Jerry H.
Well, so there we go. And as promised, this is one of our shorter podcasts. It's under an hour. No, we did.
We only just under an hour.
We were trying to get them shorter than this, but bear with us. We will get there.
Yeah.
Since we get so carried away, you know, we drag them out. There's another one coming soon, but we're going to draw this one to a close because all this talk of alcohol means we want to pop down the pub and have a beer.
I'm getting pretty thirsty. I want one of those gin tonics with 8 shots of gin.
Well, we'd just like to say, actually, before we go, thanks to those who have donated to us via Patreon. You know who you are. It's very generous of you. We really appreciate
that. We're very touched by that. That's very kind.
It helps us out massively with our outrageous hosting fees these days. Thanks to all of your downloads, that is.
And if you do wish to donate to the show, we would obviously love that.
If you're feeling guilty, if you haven't done so already.
And it's historical.podomatic.com. And if you look on the right-hand side of that webpage, there is a orange bar, a little box, and it's called Patreon. And if you wish to donate, you simply click on that and make your donation. And if you could, we'd appreciate that. That'd be very kind of you.
Very good of you. And of
but
course,
if you don't worry about it.
We won't hold it against you. And if you want to, of course, send us a... you can send us comments at the usual places, Twitter, etc. And remember, our Hotmail account is historical@hotmail.com.
And so, of course, the Twitter feed... Historical Pod, and Instagram feed as well, Historical Pod.
Yes, or our Facebook page. You know how to find these things. Guys, we don't have to tell you, do we?
So until next time, mine's a double.
Bye.